Good morning to all of those that are worshiping online with us and to all of those in our different venues. Glad that we can be together and just pray that God meets us in a special way. And maybe this doesn't qualify for all of our online audience. I've just sensed in the rooms of our sites and here that there's a little cabin fever taking place. So I pray that you'll be awakened from that, that God will break your fever, and that you'll experience the presence of the Lord in a very, very special way today. We're in a study on the book of John, and it's so extraordinary what John reveals to us about who Jesus is. So I invite you to take your teaching notes up. We're going to jump right into it. It has been called God's love letter to the world, the Gospel of John. In fact, the great reformer Martin Luther wrote these words: "Should a tyrant succeed in destroying the Holy Scriptures and only a single copy of the Epistle of Romans and the Gospel of John survive, Christianity would be saved." This book has it all. This is a book about life. It's a book about God's life and your life and how he wants us to partner together and how hard it is for us to want to partner with him because of this sin thing that we have going on. And then John draws us in. Those of us who have a knowledge of God and want to be enriched in further understanding of what it means to have God in our lives. But also he speaks and he draws in those who know nothing about God and maybe have very little interest in God. He's just a masterful writer and draws us all in. He speaks to both. And he doesn't want you to feel small. I love how he writes. He doesn't make you feel bad because of what you don't know. Have you ever been in that place where you just feel less than other people? You feel like they know so much about the Bible and you know so little and you want to just almost disqualify yourself? He doesn't write that way. He just draws all of us in. I love this about him. He makes you want to know more. Well, let me liken what happens in this gospel to an experience I had this past summer. In August, I had the privilege to tour the $150 million Allianz Stadium. It's absolutely spectacular and beautiful, the home to the Minnesota professional soccer team, the Minnesota United. And soccer in Minnesota is just going to be huge in the years and the decades that are still before us. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's going to open up in March, which is fine. I celebrate that. But honestly, I'm a basketball guy. And as a basketball guy, I love basketball. I get basketball. I know the strategy of basketball. I played the low post position when I was in high school. And I just enjoy playing the game. And after all, March is the best month of the year. March Madness is coming. I mean, I'm going to be consumed. I'm going to celebrate the opening of Allianz Field, but I mean, it's March. I'm going to overindulge on basketball. Soccer, quite honestly, I'm a bit in the dark about. I don't fully understand the game, the rules of the game. And quite honestly, I know nothing about it. And there's about this much of me that wants to know anything about it in one sense. But I think of this game, and I've tried to watch it several times, and I see these guys kicking a ball down the field, really big field, and they're kicking the ball down the field back and forth for 90 minutes. But then the ref changes the end time. I don't know if it's 90 minutes or 110. I mean, the ending of the game isn't really clear in terms of how that all comes together. And you watch for this whole thing, and then the thing ends with a tie, 0-0. And I go, why? What is this? But here's the deal. I have friends in my life who love soccer, and they're working on me. I'm full court press, to be honest with you. They know a lot about it, and I've been listening to them. Now, it's taken me a couple of years to open my ear, but wow, they are passionate about it, so passionate. They got me to go have this tour of Allianz Field, and I was drawn in. And they're working on me in this deal. They actually tell me there's a purpose for how they kick the ball down the field. And I haven't come to understand what that purpose is yet, but they're patient with me. They're trying to teach it to me. And I believe them, even though I don't understand it. And what I love about them is they don't make me feel bad in my ignorance about this game called soccer. They're intent on teaching me the game. And I want to be honest with you. I want to learn it because of their joy. They have such a passion. They make me want to learn what this game is about. And I'm going to go to the field and enjoy some games this summer. And this is a little bit like how John writes the Gospel of John. He's going to give us the tour of the big stadium called the world that we live in. And he introduces to us the creator of this world, who is Jesus Christ, and the creator of your life, who is Jesus Christ. He breathes life into you. And he explains the purpose of your life. And we all want to know the purpose of our life and the meaning of life. And he goes about doing this. And it's like John holds this big bag of soccer balls. And so I've put 7 soccer balls because the reality is he has 7 themes that he introduces all in chapter 1. It's called the prologue. I've called it the unstoppable force of God's love from the creation of the world in which we live and the new creation of the consummation when Christ comes again. It all appears in here. And each of these balls have a theme. And these balls get kicked down the field of the Gospel of John. But they get touched on all in the prologue, and we're in the prologue of John's Gospel, chapter 1. And these balls are going to appear with different themes, and quite honestly, his joy, his certainty, his completeness in terms of how he writes the Gospel makes me want to enter into it for this year and for this day. I'm real excited about it. Trust you will be too. I have to back up the truck. We're going to look at verses 14 through 18. But a couple weeks ago, we covered a couple things that really become the platform to make sense out of 14 through 18. So if you don't mind, I'm going to back up the truck, do a little bit of a review of where we are. Because in John 1:4, we hear these words from John. He's introducing conflict into the story. In him was life, and that life was the light of all humanity. And he says, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness will not overcome the light. In literary circles, this is called parallelism. And John introduces us to a really amazing concept here. And these will be soccer balls that will be kicked down the field, themes that are before us. He introduces us to light, and he introduces us to darkness. So he's telling us there's a conflict that enters into this reality of your soul. There's a battle for your soul. And he says, the darkness will try to overcome the light. But the light will shine on the darkness, and that darkness will not overcome the light. The light will win. And so he's giving us this promise of victory, but he's acknowledging the reality that we have battles in our life, that there are forces at work to keep you from knowing and having a vital relationship with this God who has created us and revealed to us in Jesus Christ. This light is connected with life in that passage, and darkness is connected with death. So you can see what he's doing here, that light gives life and darkness can lead to death. And so you have this amazing picture and the wonderful direction of what God is giving to us, that every human being, you will find your purpose and your meaning in life illuminated by the light. And the light is Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ will give life. And so how does the world respond to this incredible promise? Well, many of them don't recognize the light as light. And so they remain in darkness. And they give themselves to this bodily life that we have. And it always feels like something is missing. And John speaks to the something that is missing in the power of the light that gives to us a life. Faith is a readiness for God. And what he's saying is that some people are ready and some people are not. And he's drawing us all the way back into Genesis, which has been the story all along, that God created us for this partnership with himself, but we keep pulling away. That battle still has a way of drawing us away from the light, but the light will prevail, and he's drawing us into it. In fact, the Greek word for this English word translated life, I introduced a couple of weeks ago as being Zoe. Zoe life is spiritual life. And this becomes a soccer ball that gets repeated again and again through John's gospel. It's so rich, it is so powerful, it's so meaningful in our own personal journeys. But he's making a distinction from another Greek word for life, and I outlined it this way, and I'm going to give it as a reminder to you. Bios life, which has a start point and an end point. It's talking about the span of time that we live on this earth. That it has a beginning. We have a birth date. I talked about that when we were together last time, using myself as an example. I said something that I thought was, I just said that I was born in 1977, and you laughed at me and didn't believe me. But I know my birth date. You know your birth date. You don't know your death date. I don't know my death date, but I know my death date will come. This is my bios life. And what John points out is we give our best energy, it seems to me, to this bios dimension. And we'll spend exorbitant amounts of money for this bios dimension in order to live as long as we can on this physical plane in our bios dimension. And we may add to our lives just a little bit more because of that. And John is calling us to something more purposeful and meaningful. That this Zoe life, which is the soccer ball that gets kicked down the field, meets the bios life. And it intersects with our everyday reality and gives us the promise of no end, that there is an eternal dimension to our soul, that you have a soul. And he's saying, you pay a lot of attention to the bios life. Now pay attention to Zoe life, because the light has come to illuminate that sense of purpose and longing that you have. And that's what he's calling us into in our text today. And the reality is most of us do not want to live in darkness that could lead to death. If we're really honest about it, we want to live in the light that brings light. We don't want to live in blindness. We want to live in the light. But there's this battle that keeps getting in the way in our journey. So we pick up the story with this question based on this Zoe life foundation that was given to us. How does Jesus go about bringing about Zoe life intersected into our everyday bios life when we're dwelling in darkness? And who dwells in darkness? Well, we all fall short of the glory of God. So we all deal with darkness. So how does this spiritual life intersect it? And that's where he picks it up. So John gives us the first phase answer to it. It won't be a full enough answer for you. You're going to want more than what you're going to get today. But it's a soccer ball. He'll get to more dimensions of what it means down the road. But it's a great starting point. And matter of fact, it is such an amazing text. Cabin fever or not, I'm thrilled to share it with all of you. Are you ready for it? It comes in John's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 14 through 18. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Full. I love that. Not partial. Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son who is himself God and is in the closest relationship with the Father has made him known. Oh, the intimacy of Father, Son, Holy Spirit gets revealed to us in Jesus in this storyline. How does Jesus go about bringing spiritual life to those who dwell in darkness? Well, first of all, Jesus goes camping. It's an odd way to say it, but it's really, I think, a poignant way to look at it. John 1:14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And the word dwell among us literally has a meaning that I found to be just profound in a perspective of understanding God. Dwell literally means to pitch a tent. I want to anchor my tent in a little bit here. It's to pinch a tent. There's my tent. When you find the word dwell, it usually appears in the scriptures as a noun, meaning tent, tabernacle, temple. Whoa. He starts connecting all these storylines of God's narrative from the past. But in the passage here, it appears as a verb. So Jesus pitched his tent among us, or Jesus tabernacled among us. And you know, you got to pinch yourself around this reality because this has become, unfortunately, a commonplace kind of expression. But let me just illustrate this a little bit. My sister, Jay, and her husband, Rick, are avid campers. And they invited us several years ago, our family, to join their family on a camping trip to the Black Hills of South Dakota. So we said yes to that. We went and we absolutely enjoyed it. We get to the national park. When you get to the national park and you're getting ready to set up everything, you don't begin the process by constructing a three-bedroom house for a three-day stay. Doesn't work that way. You pitch a tent, or you park an RV, or you create a temporary dwelling for the purpose that has caused you to go to this given place. And that's what we did. So if I could illustrate that a little bit, we pitched a tent, in essence, and we had a fire that we built up. And that's what you do when you go camping, right? And then we all began to sit around the fire, smiling, enjoying each other. And there was a couple not so smiles because we had some rain, but we worked it through. All right, so we're all around the campfire. Many people call it a bonfire, but really it's a bond fire. Isn't it interesting when you go and you get to sit around a fire and there's this intimacy, this connection? And that's what happened. We deepened the bond of affection between each other and our families and our children in that experience. We told stories. We laughed a lot. We loved. And we find that this was the picture. It was a picture of relationship. That's the idea in verse 14. Let me just share a few thoughts about it. The Word became flesh. It tells us inexplicably that God became a person. It's the incarnation. It's what we celebrate every Christmas. And unfortunately, it's become such a commonplace language for us that we don't get the dimension of what's really taken place here, that God became a person. And I wish that we could hear the shattering newness of that sentence with new ears, because it's way too commonplace for us. That God pitched his tent through Jesus Christ in our midst. So in my study, I'm reading about these individuals who read the Gospel of John for the first time in their life. And one of them was a guy by the name of Junius the Younger. He was a late 16th century manuscript collector of ancient manuscripts, particularly. One of those ancient manuscripts was the Gospel of John. He reads it for the first time. He comes to this passage. He's so moved by it. He writes down what his experience is, and this is what he says. He says, "I was so affected that I instantly became struck with the divinity of the argument and the majesty and the authority of the composition. As infinitely surpassing the highest flights of human eloquence, my body shuddered. My mind was in amazement. And I was so agitated the whole day that I scarcely knew who I was. And nor did the agitation cease, but continued till it was at last soothed by a humble faith in him who was made flesh and dwelt among us." Oh, the wonder. You just sense what John is writing for us. He's capturing the wonder of our souls and our hearts for what God is wanting to do, to partner with us. And because we get so wayward and we get lost in the battle, we forget, we ignore, and he draws and pitches his tent with Jesus Christ right into our midst. What a picture this is. Jesus becomes this beautiful picture. The tent is not a place or a thing, but it's God revealed to us in the flesh of a person. And he was here for only 33 years, just a shadow of time, but more than enough time to accomplish his purpose, a purpose that would allow us to enter into right relationship with the living God, to understand what it means to partner with him as he first envisioned. He becomes the one who reconciles us to God from our place of sin and separation to oneness and vital union. And John is just drawing back all this imagery from Old Testament worship, the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, the temple. And in fact, it comes, the soccer balls. I mean, I've got 4 weeks on a tabernacle. I know you're just going to be totally in love with the tabernacle series in a few months. We'll get to that because there's so much cool insight that's relevant for us today. You'll be blown away by what gets revealed in this soccer ball of tent making. And so we find that the Old Testament system, these places symbolize the very presence of God, where he dwelt and where people met him. People approached God in those settings with sacrifice, and God met them with forgiveness and revelation concerning his will and his way and with answered prayer. So these momentary experiences with God, but now with the reality that Jesus pitches his tent with us, he becomes the tent of meeting. And this is all new. Today, God dwells within us. For Christ has offered that ultimate sacrifice that allows us to be reconciled to him. Did you get that? That Christ is now in us so that the temple takes on a whole new meaning. And so even here, how I've put it, we think of camping and the intimacy outside of the tent. He pitched his tent, yes, for the world to see. But something happens when we see the light and it illuminates our soul. And by faith, we receive his grace and we receive the life that he has for us. This is what it looks like. I'll do a picture of me. That might be the safest way to do this. My ears aren't quite that big, but... big head, small body should be the other way around. But here we go. The tent of meeting, he pitched his tent where? Here, inside of the heart. He indwells us. We become the temple of the living God. And when we embrace this truth, there's an infusion of passion and wonder and joy in our lives. It changes our friendships. It changes intimacy in marriage. It changes how we raise our children. It changes how we do our work and relate to our colleagues. There's an illuminating light within us. We are the temple. And so in essence, you find that we become the place of meeting Jesus for all people who are still in the darkness. That when we truly have received Christ, it's not about your personal salvation alone. It's the fact that there's an illuminating light in you that takes people from their place of darkness to go, what is in you? I want that light. We become the tent of meeting. You do, and I do. What an amazing picture this is. Oh, he pitches his tent, and he displays the Father's glory in verse 14. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. What a text. Glory is another soccer ball. It's going to come up again and again through the Gospel of John. It's the word that speaks in the Old Testament there. It's a hyperlink back into the Hebrew story of God's Shekinah glory. It's the glory of God that was precious to the Hebrew people because Shekinah means that which dwells. And it's the word that was used for the visible presence of God made manifest on occasion in the story of Israel and their journey. Glory is the magnificent outpouring of the radiant splendor of God and his power and his strength and his goodness and his beauty. And we find it throughout the Hebrew narrative, and we're going to find it all throughout John's gospel. In the Hebrew story, all these hyperlinks. In Exodus 16, just listen to this. In the desert, before giving the manna to the people, they're in this journey, having escaped slavery, making their way to the promised land. The children of Israel looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. They didn't know which way to go. They didn't have compasses. They didn't have maps. No, God was going to guide them through the presence manifested through that cloud. Or before the giving of the Ten Commandments, the glory of God settled upon Mount Sinai. He manifested himself. Or when the tabernacle had been erected, it says, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Or when Solomon's temple was dedicated, the priests were not able to go in and do their ministry and their work, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. When Isaiah had his vision in the temple, he heard the angelic choir singing that the whole earth was full of his glory. So in the Old Testament, the glory of the Lord came in times when God was very near. And John is telling us this beautiful story that the life of Jesus Christ was the manifestation of God's glory, his presence drawing near to us. And they saw it with what Jesus said and what he did. And we'll be seeing all these different portraits of what he said and did that become just as alive to us today as it did to the disciples then. And they're convinced that he's come from God. Only God could be and do what Jesus displayed for them. The glory of the Lord means quite simply that the presence of God is now made manifest in here. So I have a phrase in my own personal journey. It's not on my own. I hijacked it from Nehemiah some 20 years ago. And the phrase is this concerning the presence of the Lord in my life. The gracious hand of God is upon me. And I know it. And so can you. That's what happens with the presence of the Lord. And it makes all the difference in your life. And right now, if I ask you, do you sense that the gracious hand of God is upon you? You could immediately say, oh, yes, I do, or no, I don't. But probably always you would say, oh, I want it to be. And that's made feasible, possible, because of this revelation. He pitched his tent. He displays the Father's glory, and he is the embodiment of grace and truth. This is just so good. He's full of grace and truth. Isn't that great? It's not partial grace. It's not partial truth. We get the whole thing with Jesus. He is full of grace and truth. And it's the picture that helps us see that the reality of Jesus bringing spiritual life, Zoe life, that meets our bios life. in the world of darkness is because Jesus goes camping, and when he camps with a big backpack. And it's full of all kinds of things for our everyday life. John 1:16 again. Out of his fullness we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. That God, through Moses, gives us the law. And the law is really good. We know it as the Torah. It showed them how God expected them to live. It includes the Ten Commandments, which is God's gift to us, to all of humanity, with specific information on how to best conduct human existence. And we could bring it back again today. Don't you agree? We keep taking it out. We need the tangible reminders of these Ten Commandments because they have a purpose that is even good for us today. And yet it exposes things that are really wrong with us as well. It exposes, the law does, that we are unfaithful partners with this God who covenanted with us. The law gives us a framework of the relationship. In essence, the Torah says, let's get married. And so we do get married. But for everybody who's married in the room, what happens when you get married? You get to know the person whom you married in the fullness of who they are. Yeah, the good stuff that caused you to say yes. And that all that other stuff that makes you wonder at times. You can kind of, you know what he's talking about, dear. Right? Because we see ourselves fully. We're imperfect people. And we get this. And so what we find is we see these horrible things inside of us toward the covenant partner, which is why Jesus becomes the human embodiment of the Father's grace and truth. What we need is a human fullness who will take us to the next stage of fulfillment, and that's who John reveals to us in Jesus, that we break the covenant, so we need a lot of grace and truth. I need a lot of grace and truth. And I know you need it as well. And he comes to us with fullness. The big backpack that Jesus gives includes everything that we need for life. That God gives us through Jesus three things that are really clear. A supply of grace. That grace covers a wide range of meetings, but the common tone is always that of pleasantness. That grace is when God gives me what I really need in this moment. And some of you in this moment need an abundant dose of grace. And he's the one who gives it. Grace is the spontaneous, determined kindness of God. He can't help himself. We just have the kindness of God all around us, and we take it for granted. We don't always see it, but he's just pouring kindness in and over us all of the time. Grace is love freely shown to guilty sinners. That's the picture you have. And so you find that grace is showing goodness and favor in our lives when we haven't earned it or deserved it. Dallas Willard put it this way. I like his words. Grace is God acting in our life to do what we cannot do on our own. Oh, we need this. He says, grace is what we live by, and the human system won't work without it. He says, the saint uses grace like a 747 jet burns gas on takeoff. We just burn through grace all the time. It's ever present. And we come with Jesus in this backpack with a supply of truth. That all the law pointed to, all of its laws and rituals and sacrifices, were helping people be pointed to who God is in their journey. But they're all fulfilled in who Christ is. Christ is the reality. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And I love the words of Matthew's gospel that Jesus came not to abrogate the law, to say that the law, it doesn't have a place. It does have a place. He comes to fulfill it. He is the essence of it. So when we read at the beginning of John, the word, in the beginning was the word, and the word became flesh, and the word was God in that journey. Well, it's the relationship with God. He was there in the beginning. He was the relationship from the very beginning, poured out for us. That's the truth. Oh, we need truth today. Man, in this fake news world, could we get a dose of truth? Could we just trust somebody with what they say and they do, that it's the truth? Well, because of our brokenness and because we aren't faithful partners, it's really hard. I remember in my 20s when I had a mentor, had a moral failing. I was a new Christian. I was so devastated by his moral failing. It put me in a place of challenge concerning my own faith. Do I really want to believe in this God and follow this God? And then I realized, what am I thinking here? There is a standard of truth. There is a standard of right, of goodness, of nobility, and the standard is Jesus Christ. It's not people. People will always disappoint. We look to the standard, and you can trust Jesus. He was always, always trustworthy. Amen? That's our picture. That's what we get introduced to here, an overflowing abundance of the Savior as well. Out of his fullness, we have all received grace and the place of grace already given. What an interesting way of saying it. The idea of this passage is not just that it's enough grace for today. It's an overflowing abundance of grace is what he's saying. Grace and truth, undeserved blessing after undeserved blessing, realized in salvation but lived out in the bios dimension of the world we live in now. We have received spiritual life from the fountain of life that just won't run out. It's grace in the place of grace. What a strange way to try to read and understand what that means. I think it means grace upon grace. That is, different situations in life require different grace. And so we need one grace for prosperity in our lives and one grace for poverty in our lives. We need one grace for the sunlit youth of our journey and another kind of grace for the sunset chapters of our life. We need one grace in the days of persecution when we feel opposition and another grace when we feel acceptance and affirmation. We need one grace when we're sure of what's happening, of things to come, and another grace when we're filled with uncertainty what's ahead. We need one grace when life is really going well and our friendships are sweet and our marriages are bliss and our children are compliant and our jobs are prosperous and our health is terrific. That's all grace, and yet sometimes we most underappreciate grace when it just seems like all is going well. And then there's another kind of grace when our lives aren't going so well and our friendships are broken. And our marriages are a mess. And our children are not compliant. Or maybe you can't even have children. And your job isn't prosperous. Or your health is definitely not in a good place right now. That requires a kind of grace. But here's the point. Grace of God is never static. It's always dynamic. It never fails to meet the situation. You don't get some initial kick of grace when you come to faith. You get the ongoing abundance of grace for this and grace for that in the worst of times and in the best of times. When you have this tent pitched in your soul, you have access to the grace of God. All the grace you need for your life right now, and if you're in a place of prosperity or you're in a place of poverty, all the grace you need you already have in Jesus Christ. So what do you need? What's the dose of grace you could use right now? The promise is, with Christ, you get grace after grace after grace. That's the picture. So how do we receive the life Jesus offers that takes us out of darkness? Friends, he has no malicious intent towards you. He wants you to go to his Son and to believe and to trust him. In fact, you don't need to understand everything about God to understand the one thing that is most important, that God pitched his tent in your life so that you could know his grace that is abounding in whatever it is that you're going through. Blessing after blessing after blessing. Oh, man, I can't get enough of John. It's going to be a great year. Stand, and we're going to declare together the words of John that declare the reason for his writing that I've invited you to memorize. Say these with me out loud, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Lord, may we go to you and find life. May we acknowledge your ability and sufficiency and your provision, as well as our need and our brokenness and our waywardness. Might we receive your gift and trust in you and what you have done and rest in you and live by grace through faith. Grace upon grace upon grace, blessing upon blessing upon blessing to you. Praise and glory, Lord. We want it. Help us to receive it and to live in it to your glory. Amen.